source of their worry, really, but they were concerned about it. And I think that's what I mean. All of these things are being bundled together. So we're certainly seeing changes in behaviour from disadvantaged students. That many still want to go, I think, speaks to a fundamental strength of the higher education system.
Yeah, they do at the moment. Yes, they do. But if they can't get jobs either very easily because of a tight labour market, I mean, I suggest that many of them will think the contract has broken, this idea going to university.
But again, part of that assumes that 17-year-olds are able to sort of see out all those consequences in the way that the sort of the economically perfect graduate might imagine. Many of them want to go because it's a really important tool for socialisation. It's something all of their friends are doing. It's an experience of just learning about something because they want to. And yes. I think that lots of those things will stay the same. So it's not necessarily that they will not go. They might choose a less good option for themselves. Yes. They might not have the full experience.
Yes, go on.
Yeah, sorry. They might not have the full experience. But that's the challenge, is how we get to the place we want to be, not the place we've been left at.
John Blake, thank you very much for talking to us about student loans. That's it from me today. My producer was Lizzie Highfield and Ryan Boyden was the technical operator. I've been joined by Fee Glover and Jane Garvey. They're up next.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Joe. 2 o'clock. Good afternoon. It is Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio until four.
And in those 2 hours, Labour plotters might have failed to get rid of Keir Starmer, but the PM isn't safe. We're going to talk to the author of a book called How to Stage a Coup. Birmingham's striking bin workers vote to keep the walkouts going for another 7 months. A local MP is going to tell us what that means for the UK's second largest city. Should the Olympics come to the north of England? One of Team GB's brightest is backing the bid. More with Vassos on that later. And our big interview is with Lisa McGee, creator of the fabulous Derry Girls, and now How to Get to Heaven from Belfast.
Here's the news at 2, Stuart Willey.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. Former Cabinet Minister and Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham has told reporters, Sir Keir Starmer has my full support. The long-rumoured leadership challenger called for stability across the party, despite not joining a chorus of support as the Prime Minister faced a leadership crisis yesterday. Earlier, the Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, said Starmer should use the crisis as a moment of change and pivot to the left. MP Dan Carden is leader of the left-wing Blue Labour caucus. He told Times Radio the Prime Minister should grasp the nettle.
There has not been a coherent message throughout this government, and that is what we now need to rise to the challenge of delivering. I do believe that the Labour Party must ask the question, what is it for? And the answer to that is it's for working class communities up and down this country. So the ball is in the Prime Minister's court and the court of Labour MPs for us to come together and try and govern.
Ministers are being warned not to follow Wes Streeting and publish messages exchanged with Peter Mandelson. The Metropolitan Police says its vital due process is followed to avoid compromising its investigation into allegations the former ambassador to Washington leaked sensitive government information. Anna Mihailova is Times Radio's political editor.
The reason Wes Streeting wanted to do this is because over the past few days, at the end of last week in particular, his allies were saying that people around Angela Rayner started putting about the line that Wes Streeting was very close to Peter Mandelson. And it was seen as a way of strengthening Rayner's position and showing that Streeting would be tarnished by the Mandelson scandal and everything around Jeffrey Epstein.
The Prince of Wales has ignored a question about his uncle's links to Jeffrey Epstein during a visit to Saudi Arabia. It was shouted twice by a journalist after Prince William met women footballers in Riyadh.
Sir, to what extent do you think the royal family has done enough around the Andrew and Epstein issue?
Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor has repeatedly denied wrongdoing. Last night, the King insisted Buckingham Palace would assist police with any inquiry into claims his brother passed sensitive information to the disgraced financier. Elsewhere, a man has been jailed for 7 years for laying tripwires and homemade pipe bombs inspired by the film Home Alone. 60-year-old Ian Claughton used them to protect drugs he was growing at his home in the South Yorkshire village of Grimethorpe. Police had to evacuate around 100 properties after discovering the devices in 2024. masked robbers, Kalashnikovs and explosives to blow the doors off a van. It's a heist reminiscent of the Italian Job involving an armoured truck on a motorway in southern Italy. Videos taken by motorists showed at least six masked men emerging from parked cars around the van before they made their getaway in a dramatic police chase. And planned strike action at a factory in Teesside could affect supplies of crisps. Members of a union who work for KP Snacks have voted to walk out over claims of additional responsibilities without extra pay. For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Yes, that is where you find yourself at 4 minutes past two on a Tuesday afternoon. How are you doing? Are you a bit damp? Are you a bit sodden? Is it Tetchy Tuesday where you are? Join our club. We'll bring you some light and shade over the next 2 hours. You can bob along with us in the background or you could get involved 0333 003 2353 if you want to do the latter. And I guess, why not set yourself a little challenge? If you've never contacted us before, why not make today the day that you do? Jump on in. The water's warm. We're going to start by asking how you would enable a coup to happen in this country. That's not a piece for Sir Keir Starmer to be listening to. He got through yesterday, some would say by the skin of his teeth, but the machinations of power remain machinating. And we're going to talk to a man who's made that his specialist subject. We're also going to talk about the glare of the headlights, and that's not some kind of a clever metaphor or euphemism. It's literally the glare of headlights. It's making life so difficult for so many drivers. Quite a few people in rural places just can't go out at night anymore because they feel that the glare makes their driving so dangerous. And although the government has said it's looking into it, nothing so far has changed. Huge question for you in this hour of the programme too. Do you think of the UK as being a particularly corrupt country? The perception is that we are, and it's getting worse. In sport, the mighty Vassos Alexander, actually no, should we just say the perfectly adequate and very professional and knowledgeable Vassos Alexander is going to tell us about hopes for a northern-based Olympic Games in 2036. And after 3:30, sit back and enjoy.
Showbiz royalty in the form of Lisa McGee, who is the writer and creator of a new series, starts on Netflix on Thursday, How to Get to Heaven from Belfast. Lisa is the woman who gave us Derry Girls, which is probably one of the funniest and most refreshing and most original comedy series I've ever enjoyed over the years. It was an absolute nailed-on classic and still hugely enjoyable if you seek it out now. Lisa McGee's new show is a kind of comedy, caper, crime, supernatural, road trip, girl bonding saga. Have I sold it?
I think so. You've covered a lot of bases.
It's very, very funny, and it's also quite scary. Brilliant Irish scenery as well.
How super is the supernatural stuff?
Well, there's an element of the, you know, otherworldly.
The other side.
Yeah, messages coming in from the other side, and we don't mean Virgin Radio. No, it's all in there, and there's some cracking Irish talent. Some of the best Irish performers of the contemporary acting world are in How to Get to Heaven from Belfast. And we also explain the title, by the way, in the interview, because that is a great title, isn't it?
So that is all after 3:30. Simon, congratulations. Simon has simply texted to say, I'm going to get involved. That is the spirit. Most read stories on the Times website so far today are...
Number three, Michelin stars 2026, deserving winners, but some bland choices. Yes, the culinary world was on tenterhooks for the Michelin stars ceremony, yet ultimately we're told the recipe for success remained largely unchanged. This is an article by our food editor. At number two, Ed Miliband, Starmer must use Mandelson crisis as moment for change. This is the Energy Secretary taking a swipe at Wes Streeting over accusations of a leadership coup and urges Labour MPs to stop focusing on themselves. Yes, why? They're so navel-gazing. This time yesterday we thought it was all over for Sir Keir, didn't we? That's how we sold our show, in fact. Well, he's still here, and so are we. So if you want to get involved, don't be critical of us, please.
Okay, we took you to the brink yesterday. Yes. We brought you back and we're not going there again today.
Brought you right back. And the most read piece on the Times website is this brain speed game might cut your dementia risk. Now play it. exercises to sharpen the brain's processing speed could reduce the likelihood of a diagnosis by as much as 25%, according to an American study. Well, actually, later in the programme today, we're talking to Dr. Rachel Ward in our health news item about how coffee and tea supposedly could reduce your dementia risk. So it's definitely the day's talking point. You can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need a digital subscription to do so. If you don't have one, why not get one? Go to thetimes.com/subscribe. And if you want to watch the best videos from Times Radio, you can catch up on our best interviews on the Times very own YouTube channel. Just search for The Times on YouTube.
It's 8 minutes past two, so Keir Starmer says his cabinet is strong and united after ministers rallied around him yesterday. That was after the leader of Scottish Labour called on him to quit. Today, the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, who many see as the pretender to Starmer's crown, called for unity and a renewed focus on the government's successes.
To do that requires stability, and I make my own call for that today across the Labour Party. Of course, stability comes from greater unity, and that would be helped by a more inclusive way of running the party. But recent events makes that now feel possible.
The opposition isn't quite so cheerful, with Kemi Badenoch telling Sky News that the PM's resignation is a question of when, not if.
I think that all that's happened is his MPs have given him a stay of execution because they are terrified of losing their own jobs. His party leader in Scotland, who doesn't rely on Keir Starmer for his job, said the quiet bit out loud that the Prime Minister should resign. So it is only now a matter of when he goes, not if he goes. His position is clearly untenable, and I think that we need to acknowledge the fact that the country is not being governed. Nothing is happening.
So if it is a question of if not when, what do those plotting to depose the Prime Minister need to do better? Rory Cormack is Professor of International Relations at Nottingham University and author of How to Stage a Coup. Professor Cormack, a very good afternoon.
Hello.
What are your top tips?
My top tips?
Yes.
Well, the first thing you need is an apathetic or an angry population who distrust politics, first of all. And I think we can fairly safely say that that box is broadly ticked enough. So but then if you're going to spread that propaganda, which is what a coup plotter would do to try and, you know, make the population more disaffected, I think that the general sense of perma-crisis and the horrendous revelations in the Epstein affair kind of do that job for them. So let's say you've got this disaffected population, then you're going to need the support of some key groups. And in a proper coup, that would involve the military, it would involve intelligence and security regimes. In this case, it's going to involve some Labour cabinet members. And they failed, didn't they? Failed quite spectacularly yesterday, because you also need intelligence on those key groups. You need to know, when push comes to shove, are those key groups going to stand aside, side with you, or side against you? And we saw yesterday, just as the Scottish Labour leader calls for the Prime Minister to stand down, cabinet ministers publicly back him.
Yeah.
And then, sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say, I mean, yesterday was really quite odd, Rory, wasn't it? We were on air between 2 and 4. We took the live press conference from Anna Sawad. There was this feeling that something really, really big was just about to happen. And then it was literally as if somebody hadn't tied the air into the balloon. And over the course of the next 2 hours, it just went zzzz.
Yeah, they didn't have the momentum. They didn't do the legwork. They didn't get the key actors on side. And I always imagine those conversations, can you imagine, must be so delicate when you're in the corridors of power and no one wants to outright say it. But you kind of nudge. If we did, would you? And it's kind of those discreet little conversations. And that failed, the momentum lost, because the other top tip is you have to move quickly. You have to move quickly. You have to control airways, control key transport, control key buildings. Obviously, this isn't a proper coup, fortunately. But it was all a bit half-cooked. And I write books for a living on how hostile foreign states try to covertly sponsor coups and engineer regime change. And I tell you what, if I was behind the farce of yesterday, I'd want my money back. But if I was a foreign government who just wanted to create more drama and cynicism and soap opera politics and distraction, do you know what? I'd be quite happy.
Okay. So we shouldn't laugh about this too much because, as you've said yourself, I mean, in certain parts of the world, a coup is a terrifying thing, isn't it? If it's a military coup, it can be accompanied with a massive amount of aggression, intimidation and violence. We are lucky to not have to face any of that when we're talking about a coup in this country.
It's true. And technically, coups are illegal, extra legal, irregular efforts to remove the authority, which will normally involve a military takeover, an outsider. You might have a palace coup where it's the dear leader's long lost half brother. Maybe Starmer's waiting for that to come out of the woodwork back home in order to try and displace. And these things are usually violent. They are illegal and they are a source of massive instability in many parts of the world. We've seen quite a few in recent years in fact, people talk about a coup belt in parts of Africa. So these are very serious things.
Yeah. How are those coups affected by access to technology? Has it changed the method with which a coup actually takes place, or does it hinder it?
It's more difficult to control the airwaves now. So one of the key ingredients of a coup, a classic coup, would be you go in quickly, take key buildings, and you take over the national radio station. With technology decentralizing the different channels of communication, that becomes much more difficult to get that narrative. Similarly, it's probably more difficult in the old days. You would try to take key sites, transport sites, road, rail networks, key nodes. But again, with the digital infrastructure, that maybe becomes a little bit less necessary, perhaps. But who is in control of the technology gives them, whoever has it, has a great power and influence in that sense. So if you could engineer some sort of internet blackout, for example, then I would argue that probably makes a coup more likely.
Yeah. Taking control of Times Radio would be a good place for some parties to start.
It would. And I was watching yesterday to see who was putting out statements where, which channels, which platforms they were using, and almost trying to work out an unofficial hierarchy of stations of authority.
What did you find?
Oh, I don't know whether I want to hear the answer to this.
Yes, no, tell us.
Well, because it wasn't a coup in the end, it was all very disappointing. There was nothing.
Nothing
was there. No. We're all staring into a void, waiting for the coup that didn't happen.
Can you remind us of the coup that never did happen and probably was never going to, that loosely involved trying to bring down Harold Wilson? Is that right?
Yeah, so that would have been a proper coup. You know, you have the elected prime minister who there was allegedly some plotting. Well, there was some plotting. It didn't get all that far, but the idea was, you know, he was allegedly, well, so the plotters thought, a stooge of the Soviets in the hands of the radical left. Subversion was everywhere. The country was in crisis, and democracy and all of its failings, constraints and weaknesses were not up to the job to meet the huge security challenge at hand. And so there were some plotters, one or two within MI5, not very many, it gets overblown, and a few ex-generals, and they started, one ex-MI6 vice chief, and they started just plotting and creating little private armies and just testing the water in those gentlemen's clubs over cigar and brandy. What would happen if? And we think even Lord Mountbatten, one of the Queen's uncle, was he, was approached at one point to see if he might be interested. And that's the classic example of trying to get the intelligence on those key players, because he said no.
Mm,
and that was that.
The intrigue, that crossover between royals and politics.
As close as we've ever got in this country to a coup.
Yeah, fortunately, we're, touch wood, relatively coup-proof. Because you have to have a particular kind of bureaucracy, which is detached enough to be independent enough to be easily detached by coup plotters, but not too sophisticated to know when something illegal and inappropriate is happening. And I would like to think that if push came to shove, our military, our bureaucracy, our police and intelligence services would not play ball.
No. Glenn, one of our regular listeners, has said in your How to Plan a Coup slot, I could do the sandwiches if that would help. Well, it would be very helpful, Glenn. Yeah.
But not egg.
Well, I like an egg sandwich. Jane's had an egg sandwich today and it's got down. It went down very badly, didn't it?
Yeah, I don't feel that great.
It's very nice to talk to you, Rory. Thank you very much. Rory Cormack is Professor of International Relations at Nottingham University, the author of How to Stage a Coup. That is a book that no cabinet minister wants to be photographed reading on a sun lounger this summer.
They really don't. I love that reference to a small private army. I mean, I've got my own. It's a tiny
Mine's
private
medium.
Army. Is it medium?
It is medium.
You just have to go one better, don't you? Right, you are listening to Times Radio for your sins. You can keep in touch on the following number, 0333 002353. Next, why are drivers still being dazzled by those horrendous bright headlights? That's next. This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk or visit your local Wix store.
PMQ's Unpacked with Hugo Rifkind. Unpacking the politics and cutting through the crossfire on Times Radio.
Join me for PMQ's Unpacked. Each week, I'm joined by top hilarious comedians.
Just when you think he can get away with it, you'll remember his personality.
And the occasionally funny Patrick Maguire.
Look, I don't know. Yeah. As Donald Trump famously said, you're telling me this for the first time.
Will we be able to keep up? Tune in and find out.
PMQ's Unpacked with Hugo Rifkind. Every Wednesday afternoon on Times Radio.
It turns out you can please all of the people, all of the time. Garden games for the kids, a separate cottage for the grandparents, a private chef for that special occasion. Simpson Travel, idyllic Mediterranean holidays that everyone will love. We take care of the details so you can enjoy the moment. SimpsonTravel.com, because your time is precious.
My dad is more than just a dad. My dad provides life-changing support to those affected by disaster and conflict, helping people in crisis, whoever and wherever they are. Through the gift that he left in his will to the British Red Cross, my dad still makes a difference to the world, even though he's no longer with us. You can make a difference too. Please go online and search Red Cross Wills and consider leaving a gift in your will to the British Red Cross.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Right now, the kitchen and bathroom sale is on. There are options to suit every budget and every home. Browse all the kitchen and bathroom sale offers at wix.co.uk.
This from Neil, who says, I thought your guest rather overcomplicated it. I would start a coup by ensuring a major toilet roll shortage. That does seem to trigger everybody. I mean, it is true.
It did in the pandemic, didn't it?
I absolutely have to own the fact that I was an absolute bog roll bandit. I mean, I really was. I was out there buying masses of the stuff.
You've still got some in your basement, haven't you?
I have, yes. Still proudly using it.
Yeah. The use of technology in a political coup or whatever you want to call it is interesting, though, isn't it? Because unearthed recently has been this website that flashed up quite briefly in January that was Angela Rayner for Leader. Would you like to submit your email address here and join our force? And all you have to do is screenshot it. And it doesn't matter if it was a practice run or even a joke or even a scam. Mm-hmm. You are leaving such a hefty trail these days, aren't you?
You've got to be ever so careful.
You do, Jane. Be careful out there, darling.
That's the advice. If you take nothing away from this programme other than that, then frankly, we'll settle for it. Now, if you found yourself squinting behind the wheel recently, well, you won't be alone, because more than half of drivers in this country are affected by dazzling headlights. They say it's worse this winter than last, according to new research from the RAC. And as a result, about a quarter of drivers say they're now cutting back, particularly on driving at night. Rod Dennis is the RAC's motoring expert. Hello, Rod. How are you?
Afternoon. Nice to speak to you.
Yeah, thank you very much for making yourself available. Now, this isn't a new problem, is it? So why do you think people are more exercised by it this winter?
it's not a new problem. You're right. We first flagged this around about back in 2018. We've been talking to the government since that time. But I think in that time, we've seen this gradual increase in sort of concern, but also the actual tangible effect this is having on people. And I do think it's probably also partly down to the fact we have newer vehicles going onto the road every year. They have newer headlight technology, and drivers tell us that it's the whiter light that comes from those more modern headlights, which is causing them more of the problem. So if you imagine the, you know, the age of vehicles coming down, slightly more newer vehicles going out on the road, those seem to be the ones that drivers tell us are causing them the most problems. But it's a serious problem, and it's having, as you said earlier there, sort of real-world impacts on people. You know, drivers we speak to have either stopped driving, they feel much more nervous at driving, they're cutting back on their driving at night. Obviously, the clocks will be going before for too long, but anyone who needs to make journeys at night, who find it that difficult, it does indicate something needs to be done.
Well, I mean, I really feel for people who perhaps in an emergency might have to make a nighttime trip when they're really not used to doing so. That must be very alarming. Why is it that cars still have these lights?
Well, look, it's a sign of the times, perhaps. Brighter headlights do give you, as a driver, a better view on the road. A big focus for manufacturers has been about ensuring driver safety. What we've said consistently at the RAC is that, yes, drivers need the benefits of modern lighting technology, but if that is having an adverse effect on other people, on other road users as well, cyclists, pedestrians and others, that should be something that should be looked at. We want to really aim for a point where we've got the best of both worlds. We're not talking about turning the clock back and going back to sort of older halogen technology. LEDs are probably here to stay, but what can we do that?
OK, can you just explain the logic in this? As I drive at night, are the headlights on my car dazzling other road users, even as I am helped by my own headlights?
Well, it depends on the vehicle specifically. You see, right, there's lots of individual elements to a vehicle that decides whether it's dazzling or not. It's not all of them. And this is the point. This is why we've been so firm with the government that they need to do research on this. It's not the case that every vehicle you come across is dazzling you.
OK, so which vehicles are in the firing line then?
Well, we know from the TRL report the government considered, produced back earlier last year, and it was published earlier this year, that there does appear to be an indication that vehicles that sit higher on the road, predominantly SUVs, cause people in lower vehicles to suffer more.
Got you. OK, so it's the higher...
Really needs to be...
Sorry, we lost you a little bit there, Rod. You carry on with you. You were talking about SUVs. Go on.
Yeah, people who in vehicles that sit lower...
Oh, that's frustrating, isn't it? Because this is really interesting, and I know it's got quite a few of you exercised already. What does our handyman friend says? He says the biggest problem is people fitting aftermarket LED super bright bulbs in their cars that aren't designed for it and don't actually have proper headlamp fitments for it. It's just a super bright ordinary light which isn't properly focused for the super bright bulbs. And Ron says modern cars have these matrix lights. Why are these such a problem? Any idea about that? What are matrix lights, Rod? He's back with us.
Hello there, sorry about earlier. Yes, matrix lights, this is a more modern sort of technology that allows basically vehicle headlights quite cleverly to detect what is coming up and to actually block off the light. So you're potentially not causing as much dazzle as you would do with a conventional set of headlights. They are quite common on sort of upper-end vehicles, higher-end vehicles, but they are gradually working their way down. And that could be one way that we do start to see these benefits, as I say, of newer technology, but being used in the right way. Better view for drivers, not as much glare for the rest of us.
And Rod, is it actually illegal to do what our previous correspondent has suggested is being done, which is to take out the lights that your car had and to give them a kind of, you know, super woofing glare? Could you be stopped by the police for that?
Yes, you absolutely could. It is not legal to, what we say, put retrofit LED light bulbs into a car that did not have that system attached to it when the car was first manufactured. That you'd also fail your MOT for that. And in fact, we've spoken to the garages that have failed people's MOTs for that very reason. We understand why people are doing it, and it's very, very easy to buy these sorts of lights online, in many cases with no warnings whatsoever that it's not legal to use them on the road in the UK. But that is the current state of play. You can't legally use those bulbs.
Other people are saying, Rod, well, we wouldn't have these issues if we had better street lighting. What do you say about that?
I think that's a very interesting point. We do understand here at the RAC that contrast has a big part to play in the glare effects that people experience, i.e. if you're out on a very dark road this time of year, where there's no street lighting or very little street lighting, and you're hit by one of these very ultra-bright headlight systems, you do suffer the effects of glare more likely. Now, if you've got street lights, or perhaps if you're in a city centre where there is generally more lighting anyway, the effect appears to be slightly lower. So that very high contrast that we see with our eyes adapting or trying to adapt to the dark, but then suddenly being sort of ripped out of that and given this very bright light, does cause people more problems. Again, it's one of the things we think needs to be looked at.
I'm sorry, this is a world of wonder to me. I just didn't appreciate there was so much interest in this subject.
Absolutely, it is. I've got
more points for you. Alex says some vehicles have got automatic headlight adjustment, others don't. Yeah. So if you've got more people in your car or if you're carrying heavy loads, you may need to manually adjust the levels. How would the number of people in your car affect that? I'm sorry, I have no idea.
It does, because if you've got more carrying in your car, and especially if you've got more in the boot, what that effectively does is very slightly tip the angle of your vehicle backwards. So you've got more weight at the front, at the back of the car, sorry, than at the front. That causes your headlights to dip up very, very slightly. The setting in your car can readjust that. So what we should all be doing, well, I think probably most of us aren't, is whenever we are carrying heavier loads, adjusting our headlights. In many cases, modern vehicles do this for you. We've done some videos recently to explain to drivers how they can do this themselves if they haven't got one of those automatic settings. It should be done, but probably nothing is high on most drivers' lists, I shouldn't think.
OK.
Suzanne has texted in to say that she's getting flash quite a lot when she's using her headlights on a dip beam, so she suspects that she's one of the guilty parties out on the road with dazzling headlights. And it's so true, isn't it, that an awful lot of people don't realise until they are being flashed at a lot. But also, what should she do about it? Can she fix it herself?
Absolutely. This is the real irony here. You know, in many cases, the very same drivers who tell us they are experiencing this problem may accidentally be causing the problem themselves. Very little you can do, I have to say. If you're concerned that your headlights aren't performing the way they should, get them checked at a decent garage. I would not for one moment try to tamper with the system yourself. They're very sort of high-tech systems. You want to leave that light well alone. But if you're concerned there's an issue with the alignment of the bar, which may be causing the problems, get it checked by a garage. Again, an MOT should check it for you as well. But it may be through no fault of our own this is the case. Again, check the load levelling we talked about earlier. Make sure that's on the right setting. But there are other things that can cause more glare as well. If your headlights are dirty, if you're not cleaning them or wash them for a while, real problem this time of year, that can lead to more glare as well. And again, we've done a video here at the RAC with our partners at IM RoadSmart to tell drivers about the sorts of things themselves they can do to reduce the chance of dazzling other people.
Fascinating. Thank you so much for your help with that one, Rod.
Thank you. Apologies for the video.
No issues there. Don't worry. That's Rod Dennis, RAC motoring expert.
I think we could have done half an hour's phone-in on that.
Can I say, we easily could.
It's a massive, massive thing,
isn't
it? I
feel very guilty because, in all honesty, when was the last time I cleaned my headlights? I mean, you're the proud owner of a Skoda Monte Carlo. Have you been buffing up the headlights recently?
Do you know what? I just don't go anywhere particularly dirty. Do you?
Yeah, well, let's not go there.
I'm intrigued by this topic, though, because I just don't know how it's going to get solved. We seem to have more and more statistics about the problem, but we don't seem to be any closer to the solution at all. It's just gone 2:30. Coming up, how corrupt is the UK and why are we sliding down those rankings? That's after the news with Stuart Willey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, has called for stability across the Labour Party after a day of political turmoil. Sir Keir Starmer chaired a meeting of his cabinet, insisting his team are strong and united. The Prime Minister also set out his support for Anas Sawa, the Scottish Labour leader who yesterday became the most senior party figure to call for his resignation. John Boothman covers Scottish politics for The Times.
Anas Sawa wants to be the First Minister. All of their polling, all of their canvassing, all of their focus groups are telling them that the dead weight of Keir Starmer is dragging them down. That's why he made the call. A very, very simple electoral calculation.
A former inspector with the Metropolitan Police has been charged with sex offences, including 5 counts of rape. 53-year-old John Doyle is also accused of coercive or controlling behaviour and misconduct in public office. Almost 100 areas have been warned to expect flooding as the wet weather continues. Some areas have seen rainfall every day since the new year. Birmingham's bin dispute doesn't look like it will be resolved anytime soon. Workers have voted to continue strike action for another 6 months. And the British Museum will be able to keep a gold pendant known as the Tudor Heart, which is linked to Henry VIII. It's raised over £3.5 million to be able to buy it from a metal detectorist who found it in a field in Warwickshire 6 years ago. Don't forget, you can set the Times Radio News Briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Romantic retreats, luxury beachfront hotels, expansive family villas with sensational sea views. Not lots of, just the very best of. Simpson Travel, the magical destinations you love, the personal service you expect. We visit every one of our properties so we can handpick the perfect holiday for you. SimpsonTravel.com, because your time is precious.
Get a first look at tomorrow morning's front pages. Tonight from 10 with Carol Walker on Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Ready to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom? If you'd like a personalised design, the Wix free design service can guide you through the whole process, including a free home measure. Book today at wix.co.uk.
John Pienaar takes over from us at 4 o'clock. Hello, John.
Hello.
Where will you start?
Well, I'm going to be just looking at yesterday. What it really meant. How did we get to where we are today? And where are we going from here? That's got different, interesting legs to it. I mean, just how close the danger was to Keir Starmer yesterday. You know, one or two people who didn't do what they might have done was the difference. And combined with a pretty efficient, you know, defence operation by those left at number 10 Downing Street, and the fact there was so much indecision among Labour MPs, combined to give him this breathing space, which is just a breathing space. You know, it's not over. And the MPs you're seeing and hearing quoted saying, yeah, it's all over now. I mean, the danger has passed. It really is not. So we're talking about that. We're looking at the wreckage of the Scottish relationship. So, you know, the Scottish Labour Party is pretty much divorcing itself now from UK Labour after what Sawa did. I'm going to be talking about, will that do them much good when it comes to the elections? And I'm talking about other things too. A good hour at the end of about my time at 6 o'clock, just going right through where we are with the Epstein files, the American story, the British story, and what's come to make this what it is, which is a huge story, and for British politics, nothing less than a redefining moment.
Absolutely, in all kinds of areas. Just one quick question. The third dump of Epstein files, does anybody have an idea when that will come?
Well, I mean, so we've had, at the beginning of all of this, we were told, weren't we, by the Justice Department in Washington that there were maybe 6 million documents. We have had 2.5-3 million documents, still 3 million unaccounted for. And there are different versions of that. The Justice Department say a few thousand haven't come out. Others are saying millions have not come out. And that is still the tug of war that's going on now. What's in them? Why haven't we seen them? Does the government's ideas of nothing there that you need to see, or a part of a big cover-up? That's the argument that's raging on at the moment. I'm going to be talking about that after six.
Super stuff. John joins us after 4 o'clock this afternoon. It is now 24 minutes to three. Scandals like the links between Lord Mandelson and Jeffrey Epstein don't help this country's international reputation, especially when it comes to how corrupt or not we're perceived to be. The Corruption Perceptions Index puts the UK as sliding down the rankings. Transparency International runs that index, and we're joined by their UK Chief Executive, Daniel Bruce. Hello, Daniel. How are you?
Hello, good afternoon. Very well, thank
you. Good. Where are we in the rankings? Break it to us gently.
So today's result sees the UK sitting at its lowest score of 70 out of 100, where 100 is completely clean and zero is, in theory, completely corrupt. We have been stuck at 20th in the global rankings for three consecutive years now. And whilst, you know, relative to many other countries around the world, one of the things I always say about this index is the most important thing is to look at what each individual country's score is doing. And back in 2017, we were a top 10 country with a score in the mid-80s. And then we've seen a successive decline since then. 3 years ago today, we plummeted 6 points. And then we've lost this extra point today, down from 71 last year. So the score is pointing the wrong way for the UK, and it shows that more concerted action is needed to deal with that.
What has made us drop?
So the index itself is, it's a poll of polls. It's a kind of survey of surveys that draws in data from things like the Economist Intelligence Unit, the World Economic Forum, the World Bank, and so on. And so we can see when we look at some of those individual data sources, which we then normalise in the index, where particular concerns are heading in a certain direction. And again, for another consecutive year, we're seeing an increased level of concern among the global experts, business leaders and academics that feed into those polls about political corruption in the UK. And that's been the same for a number of years now. Concerns about patronage in the House of Lords, concerns about cronyism in government, across the whole complexion of governments that we've had in recent years now. Mm.
Lobbying was always going to be and always is the next big scandal to break. And it's never truly broken, has it? It breaks in little bits and pieces and stories.
Yes, this is such an important point, because one of the things that we've seen with all forms of scandal successive governments doing is responding to individual bits of scandals in an isolated way. And I think, frankly, that's what we're seeing going on at the minute. It's all about, you know, Peter Mandelson and his peerage and how, you know, he may or may not be stripped of that title, rather than looking at the systemic reforms that we need. On the issue of lobbying, that's absolutely one of our calls, that we've got to bring lobbying out of the shadows. It was David Cameron who introduced the lobbying register that we now have to apparently bring transparency to the lobbying and influence of government policy. But it's a fig leaf. It only records the activities of so-called consultant lobbyists, which
it's interesting, that one as well, isn't it? Because he then gave offices in Downing Street to people who a lot of other people might raise eyebrows at in terms of lobbying, banking and making lots of money. We'll park that for a second. What can we do to go higher up the rankings, though? Because presumably one of the huge problems with all of this is that, you know, corruption doesn't announce itself. It is happening in the shadows. So you can't ever really tackle all of those different bits of mould if you can't see them.
I think we have a repository of data, though, from the last 10 or 15 years now that shows where the biggest problems are. And so when we get those scandals popping up and when you can see the mould, you know, I can tell you where it's going to come from, frankly, on the basis of our research and investigations. We know that money in politics and the need to clean up political finance is a key part of the picture. We know that properly reinforcing standards in the heart of government to build public trust is absolutely critical, and that's what a lot of polling and research will tell you. And we know that preventing corruption in Parliament in all of its forms is absolutely key. And what we've seen previous governments and this government doing, it's just tinkering at the margins of all of the reforms that are really needed. And I think today's score is starting to pick up periods of time where we saw the most expensive general election campaign in history in 2024. It picks up, you know, self-contained scandals around Labour's biggest donor, Lord Alley, getting a pass to 10 Downing Street and those sort of things. So it is starting to be a measure of this new government as well, whilst carrying a lot of historical data. And all this government has done thus far, whilst making bold pledges in its manifesto, is just make little adjustments here and there. And they don't build public trust, and neither do they deal with the root causes of that corruption when it does surface.
We're by no means as bad as other countries. I mean, obviously, there are countries above us in the rankings, or below us, whichever is the worst place to be. So can we at least hold our heads high about that? We're kind of sliding with the rest of the world. If you look at the money that pours into an election in America by comparison to what pours into our elections here, we are more carefully considered and regulated, aren't we?
Yes and no. We're not going the right way. That's the problem, particularly on political finance. The UK absolutely doesn't have the same absolute sums of money when we were talking, $14, $15 billion that went into the last US presidential election relative to £94 million that parties spent on their election campaigns in the UK last year. And yeah, that's loose change comparatively, but we're not doing anything to arrest the arms race for more cash in UK politics.
Which government would ever vote for change, though, after they've got in? Because, you know, part of that election victory would have rested on exactly those donations.
It has to, exactly. And, you know, bluntly, turkeys don't vote for Christmas. And it's one of the great big challenges that, you know, we saw the Reform UK Party getting the largest single donation from a living person just before Christmas, £9 million. And Labour emailed out all of its supporters on the day this was published by the Electoral Commission, and said, please give us more money, because we know that the people with the most money will win elections. Well, our elections shouldn't be for sale. And all that does is just erode public trust that our politicians are there to serve them and that it's a truly representative democracy. There's an elections bill coming soon, and we welcome many of the loopholes around malign foreign interference and anonymous donations that the government is trying to close with that. But it's absolutely silent on the issue of a need to cap donations and spending. And that could be done in a very regulated, sensible way. The Labour Party in Australia did it and won an election on that promise just last year.
Tell us a bit more about the countries that do well. How do they do so well?
So there is a bit of a pattern that a lot of the Scandinavian countries tend to come out top. So Denmark remains at first rank.
I mean, Denmark. It's just always good in Denmark.
It's 89 out of 100 compared to our 70. And then again, you know, Sweden, Norway, Finland, relatively all quite high scoring. Switzerland, Singapore does quite well as well. So they're all sort of top 10 countries. The bottom country again this year is South Sudan. There is often a correlation between countries facing acute internal or cross-border conflict and perceived levels of corruption because of the sort of collapse of rule of law and so on, as you might imagine. But I think one of the global trends that's really concerning us this year is that the data are quite stubborn. Two-thirds of the world remains below 50. And it is those mature democracies like the UK, the United States, France, Belgium, that are sliding in their scores. And the worst thing we can do is be complacent that, you know, we're have the mother of all parliaments just down the road and it's all going to be fine. And I think the revelations of recent days and weeks show us that we must have much bolder action from government to arrest this decline.
Well, thank you very much indeed for coming in and talking to us today.
Thank you.
You got the envelope with the money for it.
Sorry?
You got the envelope with
I
the
have,
money for
yes,
it.
But I wasn't going to draw attention to it in such an obvious way.
I wasn't supposed to mention it.
All right, Neil Hamilton, you pipe down over there. Right, it is 3:15.
Yes, it is. And you're with Times Radio. I should say our big guest a little bit later at about 3:30 this afternoon is the brilliant Northern Irish writer Lisa McGee. She is the creator of Derry Girls. It was such a big hit, rightly so, on Channel 4. Her new programme, it's on Netflix, starts this week. It's called How to Get to Heaven from Belfast. And Lisa is, frankly, a televisual genius. You can hear exactly how she came up with that programme at about 3:30 this afternoon. Coming up, it's the health news with Dr. Rachel Ward. And we're discussing whether or not tea and coffee really can cut your risk of dementia. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wicks, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
The Evening Edition with Kate Borsay on Times Radio, hosting an honest conversation about current affairs, well-being, lifestyle, health and wealth. Plus, don't miss Tomorrow's Home, highlighting how you can make your house more energy efficient. The Evening Edition with Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio. With the UK government's boiler upgrade scheme, you could upgrade your heating with a £7,500 heat pump grant. Visit gov.uk/cleanenergy to check eligibility.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house,
and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly.
To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Have you seen the texts about corruption? Do you want to read some of those out? Everybody's very, very concerned today with everything we're discussing, which is great, by the way. We appreciate it.
I'm going to sight read some of these.
Okay,
so just stop me if you've pre-read them and I'm going too far. In from Sean, who says, on corruption in the UK, this narrative of broken Britain. Maybe Britain isn't broken. Maybe what's broken is the British establishment. If you look at all the scandals of the past decade, who's at the centre? Politics and the church. Sean, I don't think you'll get any disagreement from us on that one.
No, we'll let that one go, definitely. You can...
keep the conversation going on anything you like, really. Largely, we hope, things we're discussing on the programme. But 0333 003 2353. I like the message that said that they thought that John Pienaar, it was from Ian, wasn't it? John Pienaar was absolutely on it yesterday. He was overflowing with adrenaline at the prospect of an imminent big story. And it didn't quite happen yesterday. And it probably won't happen today. But that doesn't mean there won't be plenty to look forward to on his show between 4 and 7.
Yeah, but the suggestion was we should give him a bit of peppermint tea.
Yes.
But we can't control our John.
We can't control John. And I
wouldn't want to.
If I was going to hazard a guess at his favoured beverage, I wouldn't say a herbal tea would be in there. What do you think?
Oh, I don't know.
No.
I think he's a man of surprises.
I once stood behind a man at a previous... broadcaster who employed both of us, and I have never ever laughed as much. The man, he was a man, he asked for
what?
He asked for a week Lady Grey, and I just thought, oh, that's, oh, call yourself a man. And I shouldn't have made that judgment. That was wrong of me. Right, it's 11 minutes to 3. It's Times Radio. Bowel cancer has doubled in the under 50s. And that means that scientists are now really keen to identify what's causing this. Is it lifestyle? Could it be genetic factors? What is the reason? Dr. Rachel Ward is a GP and co-host of the Pharmacy podcast. So what are they looking at as potential causes? Because there's no doubt, although we should say the figures are not enormous, I wouldn't want to alarm people, there's definitely been an increase, Rachel.
Good afternoon. Yes, this has been a marked increase. So a couple of interesting statistics. So we know that bowel cancer is the fourth most common cancer in the UK. There's 44,000 diagnoses each year. 94% of those will be in over 50-year-olds. But that does leave 2,600 in the age category below that. Mm. But we know certainly since the 90s, there has been a double in the number of younger people having bowel cancer. So there's been a lot of research going on around this subject because this trend has been noted for some time. And there are several theories. So one of the big things, which, you know, seems relatively obvious in some ways, is looking at our diet and our eating habits. So Professor Sarah Berry, who's a professor of nutritional studies at King's London, believes that a large element is down to our diet. And there's multiple factors. So, you know, we drink more alcohol, we eat more red meat, we have more processed meat. We have very little fibre in our diet compared to what we should. 90% of adults in the UK do not eat enough fibre. You know, I'm always banging on about fibre. We see so much about protein, but fibre is what we really need to work on in our diets. And we also have huge rates of obesity. So we know that 64% of adults in the UK are either overweight or obese, and this increases your risk of bowel cancer. So these are things which I would say many of us are kind of familiar with. But there are some also really interesting theories coming out at the moment. So there is something called the childbirth theory, which is by Paul Brennan. And he has noticed that the genetics of the cancers that we are seeing in younger people are different. And actually, there seems to be a higher proportion of cancers which have been affected by a type of E. coli, the bacteria in our gut. And he has several theories about the fact that the gut flora in children, in infants, is changing. Right. There's several reasons why that could be. And this is kind of early on in the stage of proving this link and how we do anything about it. But fascinating that they are finding these different genetic changes in this age group.
When you read about bowel cancer in young people, you do hear of people who have gone to their GP, and I wonder if this has happened in your surgery, Rachel, yeah, and they've been told, well, that's probably IBS, go away, yeah, you're too young to have cancer. Well, unfortunately, yes, you're not, are you?
No, and I think we are all aware that, you know, we are seeing more cases in younger people. I think one thing that has really changed is that over the last it must be kind of 4 or 5 years, we have access to a really good test, called the FIT test, the fecal immunochemistry test. And this looks for altered blood in the stool, which is microscopic. You know, you can't see it with the naked eye. It's similar to the test that we do in national bowel screening, but it is a higher sensitivity. And this is such an easy test for anybody to be doing with bowel symptoms. You know, it's non-invasive, easy to do. And so really, I think now we are doing more tests in younger people because we have access to them. But yet, of course, we always have the concern because statistically, you know, if you are younger, let's be honest, it is likely to be something other than bowel cancer, thank goodness. But it's important that if your symptoms are not getting better, you go back to your doctor and you get seen again.
Okay. And your symptoms might be what? Blood in your poo, but
yeah,
also
blood in your pool, change in your bowel habits, either going less, going more, change in shape, change in consistency, abdominal pain, weight loss, unexplained fatigue and tiredness. They're your kind of common ones. Occasionally people will feel a lump in their tummy around their back passage. But yeah, there's a lot of symptoms. But any, I always say with cancer, it's all about noticing a change in what's normal for you.
Okay, and don't be embarrassed because your doctor's literally seen and heard it all before.
Many times a day. Yeah,
exactly.
It's normal discussions for us. Do not be embarrassed.
Okay, I do think it's always just worth mentioning you really have seen everything, Rachel, right?
Yes.
I'm always a little worried when we say that things might prevent dementia. And the latest is the notion that regular tea and coffee drinking might help you avoid dementia. People are obviously very concerned about the risk of dementia. That it's the lead story on thetimes.com at the moment, some sort of brain test that you can take to show how likely you are to develop it. Of course, people are worried, but can caffeine really help you avoid it? What do you think?
Well, so there is a large study that's come out of Harvard. They looked at 131,000 people and they followed them for 40 years. So a really significant observational study. And as part of that, you know, they were looking at lifestyle elements, but people recorded how many caffeinated drinks they had. And they were tracking their memory. They were tracking their health over this period. And what they found was that if people were having 2 to 3 cups of caffeinated drinks, so tea or coffee per day, it had the optimal impact that they had less chance of getting dementia. So they had an 18% less chance of getting dementia than those who were not regularly drinking caffeinated drinks. If you were having 1 to 2 cups a day, then you had 16% less chance. Now, this is an observational study. It cannot prove cause and effect. So, for example, it may be that there is something else linked to people who are tea and coffee drinkers. Are they generally having healthier lifestyles? We cannot prove it in this study, but there is certainly does seem to be a link. We do think that caffeine has properties of kind of inflammation, and it helps us protect us from building up toxic proteins in our brain. And so there does seem to be some positive, encouraging correlation. Another really interesting thing was that people who drank decaf drinks didn't get that benefit. So that's also really interesting. So no, we cannot say that this is definitely going to reduce your risk of dementia, but we know that drinking caffeinated drinks, people who drank them did not see negative impacts, and people that drank more than 3 a day didn't have any negative impact.
Okay. Well, that was going to be my next question, because The Times has got a live poll up on thetimes.com asking people how many cups of tea they drink a day. And the winning option at the moment from readers is more than 3. But you can reassure us that it's perfectly all right to have, I don't know, 7 or 8 mugs of tea a day.
So thinking about kind of tea and coffee, we're thinking about the dementia element here. Are there any kind of negative impacts? Well, first of all, if you drink, you know, lots of tea and coffee all day and you're not drinking water or, you know, things as well, you can actually become dehydrated. It's not a good hydration drink, drinking tea or coffee, because the caffeine actually makes you pee. So you can end up peeing more than you've drunk. So theoretically, you can be get more and more dehydrated if that's all you drink. For people who have problems with their bladder, problems with things like heart rate and stuff, yes, having lots of caffeine can be problematic. There's also recommended limits in pregnancy. But on the whole, you know, if you're drinking a few cups of coffee a day, there is potentially some benefit. You know, like everything in life, of course, there's going to be extremes and there's going to be problems with extremes. But on the whole, in that kind of moderate level, it seems to be a good thing.
OK, thank you very much for that. Reassuring. Now, briefly, we know that there's an ambulance crisis, but in Wales, they're using tech to attempt to tackle it and having some success. What they're doing is they're not sending ambulances out every single time. It seems bold and it appears to be working.
It does. So they really hit crisis point in South Wales, and they were really struggling with their response times. And actually, there were 20 avoidable deaths between 2022 and 24, according to the Preventable Death Tracker, related to these diseases. So, that they, you know, the delays. So they really had to do something about it. So, yes, you're absolutely right. What they do now is if you have one of the kind of life-threatening conditions, such as anaphylaxis, choking, excessive bleeding, cardiac arrest, you get an immediate emergency ambulance. But if you don't have one of these, the listed conditions, you then get triaged by a professional that may be a nurse, it might be a paramedic. And they will use multiple methods of assessing what you need. They might do a video consultation, for example, to get more information. And it may be that they end up sending an ambulance, but it may be actually that they put in place multiple different other pathways. So helping you get in touch with your GP, sending out an advanced nurse practitioner. They even have a whole group of volunteers in their community, 280 community welfare responders who have some first aid training. They can go and do things like take people's blood pressure, send information back to base. And so they're really using lots of different techniques, and it seems to be working.
Well, we'll keep
they're meeting targets better, and you know that's only got to be positive.
We'll certainly keep an eye on it. Sounds very interesting initiative. Thank you, Rachel, GP and co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast. That was Rachel Ward.
Now, Keith, one of our regular texters, says, Jane and Fee, what's the matter with a man liking the occasional baby sham?
Oh, nothing, but I didn't say anything about baby sham.
You're not going to get out of it that easily, love.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
I think the next hour is going to be ever so spicy now. It's 3 o'clock, you're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. It's still to come. Birmingham bin workers have voted to extend their strikes until after the May elections. We're going to hear from the Labour MP for Edgbaston. The runner, Keely Hodgkinson, has called for the Olympics to be held in Manchester. Vassos Alexander has more on that. Our big guest today is screenwriter Lisa McGee, discussing her new show, How to Get to Heaven from Belfast. And it's all after the latest headlines with Stuart Willey.
Fee, thank you. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister has come out fighting, criticising reports of Labour's woes and insisting he'll never walk away from the job. Sir Keir Starmer says the real battle is with Reform UK and the politics of grievance. Earlier, the Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, said Starmer should use the leadership crisis as a moment of change and pivot to the left. But at an event in Hertfordshire, Sir Keir Starmer said he was proud to have the most working-class cabinet in history.
There are some people in recent days who say the Labour government should have a different fight, a fight with itself. And I say to them, I will never walk away from the mandate I was given to change this country. I will never walk away from the people that I am charged with fighting for. And I will never walk away from the country that I love.
Meanwhile, ministers are being warned not to follow Wes Streeting and to publish messages exchanged with Peter Mandelson. The Metropolitan Police say it's vital due process is followed to avoid compromising its investigation into allegations the former ambassador to Washington leaked sensitive government information. Anna Mihailova is Times Radio's political editor.
The reason Wes Streeting wanted to do this is because
over the past few days, at the end of last week in particular, his allies were saying that people around Angela Rayner started putting about the line that Wes Streeting was very close to Peter Mandelson. And it was seen as a way of strengthening Rayner's position and showing that Streeting would be tarnished by the Mandelson scandal and everything around Jeffrey Epstein.
The number of state school teachers earning over £125,000 has jumped by 150% in 5 years. Analysis of government data by the financial planning firm Quilter shows nearly 1,200 teachers are paid more than that, bringing them into the top rate of tax. Wages for teachers have risen by nearly 25% since 2021. Four people have been remanded in custody after appearing in court charged with the murder of a teenager in South Wales. 17-year-old Tristan Shaker was found dead at a property in Caerphilly 5 days ago. The defendants have not yet entered pleas and face another hearing in April ahead of a potential trial in August. Weather warnings over persistent and heavy rain have been extended to more parts of Scotland. The Met Office says a yellow warning could mean travel disruption and localised flooding. Meteorologist Joe Wheeler says the wet conditions aren't going away.
Parts of Scotland have had 180% of their monthly rainfall already, but down towards the southwest, it has been exceptionally wet. And it's now the 41st day of 2026, and some people have seen rain every single day. We've actually got high pressure up over Scandinavia, which is blocking anything coming through.
And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
4 minutes past three and a very good afternoon to you. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover until four. Thanks for all your input this afternoon. 0333 003 2353 is the WhatsApp. Lisa McGee, the creator of Derry Girls, has a new show on Netflix. You can hear from her after 3:30 this afternoon. The programme is called How to Get to Heaven from Belfast, and it's as good as the title might suggest. It's very entertaining indeed. Plus, Vassos is back, our sporting giant. He'll be discussing what sounds like a bold bid, potentially, for the Olympic Games to come to the north of England.
2036.
Wow, that would be incredible, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And I wonder how that looks from afar. So if we were doing a news story about, let's say, what would a country a similar size to ours be?
Abroad?
Yes.
An abroad country. Abroad. Yes. Oh, my goodness, you've got me there. So population of about, what, 62, 63 million?
Yeah.
Well, France is a bigger country but with a smaller population. I don't know. Oh, you've put me on the spot here.
Well, how would we feel about an Olympic Games that was billed as being in the north of Belgium, not in the south of Belgium? I wonder how this appears to our foreign counterparts.
Well, you picked a very difficult country there because, of course, Belgium is an artificially created nation, isn't it? I mean, you've got your Walloons, you've got your Flemish. I mean, it's really complicated. French speakers. You've got the lot there. So I don't know why you picked Belgium.
I'm going to go with Finland.
Finland. I think people would probably find it perplexing. But the north of England could offer, for example, can you imagine if they had some events in the Lake District?
Oh, I think it'd be phenomenal.
It would be absolutely incredible, wouldn't
it? And it's not as if the north hasn't hosted some spectacular events before.
Spectacular.
Spectacular. The Commonwealth Games in Manchester.
Absolutely. Keep your thoughts coming on this perspective.
I think we've done ever so well in that segment.
That's called filling, everybody. Right. And we did do quite well there. Yes, could the Olympic Games be held in the north of England? Have a ponder. Now, Keir Starmer is the Prime Minister. He's been speaking in the last half an hour. These were his first comments in public since the intervention yesterday of the leader of Scottish Labour, Anna Sawa. He, of course, on this programme, called for Sir Keir Starmer to stand down as PM.
There are some people in recent days who say the Labour government should have a different fight, a fight with itself, instead of a fight for the millions of people who need us to fight for them. And I say to them, I will never walk away from the mandate I was given to change this country. I will never walk away from the people that I am charged with fighting for. And I will never walk away from the country that I love. The fight coming up in politics, the real fight, is not in the Labour Party. It's with the right-wing politics that challenges that, the politics of reform. the politics of divide, divide, divide. Grievance, grievance, grievance that will tear our country apart. That is the fight that we are in. And I will be in that fight as long as I have breath in my body.
Well, that is Sir Keir Starmer in defiant mode, speaking probably only about half an hour ago. So he's in action this afternoon. Well, domestic politics stop for no one, and he won't have been happy to hear today that the Birmingham bin strike rumbles on. Members of Unite have voted today to keep their industrial action going, extending it now beyond the May local elections and right through potentially until September. So I've been talking to one of the MPs impacted, Preet Kaur Gill, a Labour MP for Birmingham Edgbaston, not just about the strikes, but about the general mood within the Labour Party after that spirited, we're told, speech by the Prime Minister to assembled Labour MPs at Westminster last night. And we began by discussing, though, her reaction to the Unite vote.
Well, look, I think it's really disappointing. I met with Unite bin workers a couple of weeks ago. Some of them were obviously my constituents. I've also met with commissioners alongside some of the Birmingham MPs. And then I myself met with John Cotton and the chief executive of Birmingham City Council. And there was a debate in the Westminster Hall about the bin service. And what I was calling for is all sides to come together and bring this dispute to an end. So I think, look, people will be really, really concerned that this is going to continue. But the rubbish has been collected. Waste is being collected every week. But, you know, this is just not good enough, and it's not what the citizens of Birmingham would have wanted to hear.
Right. The union says there haven't been negotiations to actually end the dispute since May. Is that correct?
Well, look, I think an offer was put on the table. You know, that wasn't accepted.
But that was back in May.
That was back in May. I think there has been some ongoing official-to-official conversations being had. But yes, I mean, the offer has been rejected and the strike has continued. There's been issues at the depot, the council having to go and get another injunction. So there's been a number of issues going on. But fundamentally, we have got to bring this to an end now. And there is only what's left is what I'm told is a smaller dispute that the council has got to provide a sort of offer as need to come together.
How many people are actually out on strike?
Well, I mean, obviously, the Unite workers are out on strike.
But how many people is that?
Well, there's quite a number of them. I don't have the exact number.
Well, is it 40? Is it 140?
Well, I mean, on each of the picket lines, you know, there is about 20 to 30 people there at least. But the point is that the disruption obviously is about making sure that citizens still have their waste collection, and that's what the council's primary concern is. And when the depots are being blocked, that's an issue. But we are talking about a number of workers that have accepted already the roles that were downgraded down. There was a dispute about those on the top of, you know, the grading, the drivers, and then coming down to the next grading and how much loss there was. And so all this has got to be worked out.
Is it something that is an issue that your constituents mention to you at surgeries week in, week out?
Well, they want to understand why the strike has continued and why now it's going to continue. They also accept that this is now not a huge number of people that are left within this dispute that haven't accepted the agreement. And that's why they want this to be brought to an end. The council's got to equally accept equal pay liabilities and the advice it's given. It has come out of the financial difficult situation they were in. The government's given them almost £500 million more multi-year settlement. That has really helped the council get back on its financial feet. And so, you know, we've got to bring this dispute to an end so we can transform the service, and the council will continue to do that. So from June, people can expect their recycling to resume.
Now, I understand that for various work-related reasons you weren't at Westminster yesterday, but what have you heard about the atmosphere at that meeting of the Parliamentary Labour Party addressed by Keir Starmer? What have people told you?
I heard it was very, very positive. What people heard was a Prime Minister, very honest, very clear, you know, making the case as to why we've got to serve the people that elected us and deliver on our manifesto commitments. And that's his primary concern. And he is not going anywhere. And that's a very, very clear message, a strong message to the PLP. But that's exactly what's needed. He is the Prime Minister and the leader that the Labour Party needs right now. I have full confidence in him. We've got to stop those few people that are clearly trying to fall for the division that's being sowed here need to get on and remember that the British public have elected us.
Well, I mean, some of those people on manoeuvres, notably the leader of Scottish Labour yesterday, Wes Streeting, Angela Rayner, these people are, they are jockeying for position. They're keen to make their mark. Do you think that in the end we'll look back on this galvanising speech that Sir Keir Starmer made as just something he did to stave off the inevitable?
I think, look, I've served in Keir Starmer's shadow cabinet and as a shadow minister. I've worked really closely with a man that I see who has got a huge amount of integrity and really cares about making sure we deliver. I worked very hard, like he did, in 8 years in opposition to get to this point of electing a Labour government, and we have one. And we've got to make sure that we are communicating our clear sense of purpose, not just fixing the mess of the last 14 years. That's important. But we've also equally got to give hope and a vision as to where we are taking the country and why the investments and the delivery we've done so far is supporting us to get there.
And yeah, I mean, you know what, I'm bound to say this. This fundamentally decent man, Keir Starmer, thought it was all right to give Lord Mandelson that job. It beggars belief.
Well, look, what I would say is what was out in the public domain is exactly the information that he had. What we can't do is speculate as to what extent of information he had. But when the information changed in September, he sacked him on the spot. He acted swiftly.
But Preet, I can't be alone in just finding it incredibly hard to believe that the man who was the director of public prosecutions, a highly accomplished lawyer, wasn't equipped to look at Mandelson, to look at his record, and to think, this guy is an absolute wrong'un, and I cannot give him this position.
Look, he's accepted that it was a wrong decision. He's accepted and wants to make very clear that his primary focus is apologising to the victims, which is exactly what he did. Leaders have got to delegate and entrust people to carry out decisions based on their values and not play factional politics within that. And every time he had the information available, he sought to get clarity and get the Cabinet Secretary to look into the information. There is a vetting process, clearly, that needs to be looked at. But fundamentally, yes, he's accepted, as a leader would, and as our Prime Minister has, that he is sorry, it was a wrong decision. But equally, he is evidence-basing what facts he had available when he took those decisions.
Look, some people do believe, but notably I think quite a few women in the Labour Party believe, that there was just too much of a boys' club atmosphere around the Prime Minister and that probably didn't help in the decision-making about Lord Mandelson. Do you think that might be a valid point?
I think in great organisations, you have got to look at who are the advisers in that role, because there are two women, Vidya and Jill, who are equally the deputy chief of staff.
Who are now the chief advisors.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, so there has. But fundamentally, this is about who has accountability and responsibility for what. And what is the direction of that leadership, you know, from the top. And I think Keir is very clear. He's been always consistently clear that we are here to serve and we're here to deliver. And delivery has got to be the fundamental, relentless focus now of government to make sure people feel and see the difference that this government is making locally to them, and that they're, you know, and that's why Pride in Place is really important, and policies like that, because democracy is too removed from people.
I mean, I don't doubt there'll be many people listening who actually think, you know what, things have improved. I've got my NHS appointment and I'm pleased with the way things are going. But that information just doesn't appear to be able to be communicated by our current Prime Minister. He's simply no good at that side of the job. What do you say to that?
What I say to that is it's not just the Prime Minister's responsibility to communicate. There's a whole cabinet and ministers, and it's the responsibility of the civil service who are there to deliver for the public to make sure that communication is getting cut through. We equally have got to have, you know, journalism looking at actually what is the delivery of government. We have got too caught up in the kind of Westminster bubble of what's going on, which many people's lives are not affected by. When I'm out on the doors talking to people, they want to hear clear about the delivery that they're not hearing because it's not getting cut through in the media about the difference we are making, the fact that we've got neighbourhood policing, the fact that we're addressing the NHS waiting list, they can get a GP appointment, free breakfast clubs. Let's not underestimate some of these policy initiatives.
I'm really interested then, when you're on the doorstep, are people mentioning Mandelson and Epstein, or are they more concerned about being able to restart their recycling?
Honestly, they want this government to succeed, but they are equally affected about what's happening locally, and they want to stop hearing about the nonsense of personalities that don't affect their direct lives. They want to hear about what is government doing to make the change that it was elected on.
But, I mean, a genuine question that I'm sure you can answer. Has anybody in a surgery or on the doorstep talked to you about the appointment of Lord Mandelson as UK ambassador to the States?
I mean, a few people have raised it, but it hasn't been, like I say, it's not what people are talking about on the ground. You know, people not are not as interested as we might think. And, you know, they also know that the information that Keir had at the time was out in the public domain. And this is a man who is committed to addressing violence against women and girls, not just as a something to say, but actually delivering in terms of policies.
Yeah. And, I mean, again, he did say in PMQs last week, didn't he, the Prime Minister, that he did know that Mandelson had maintained his friendship with Epstein after the events, after he had been in prison for those offences.
But it's also been said that Mandelson, you know, lied clearly, because the information he gave suggests that he'd hardly had a relationship. What maintained meant is obviously speculative at the moment, because we don't have all the facts.
Just very briefly, do you dread more coming out? We know there will be a release of more information, more files, more messages between various members of the Labour Party. Are you worried?
I take very seriously the information that is coming out. I think all of us should. What we are seeing is, you know, elitist men exploiting vulnerable women and girls. And it is horrific to read some of the stuff we've already seen. Keir Starmer is not mentioned in the Epstein files, you know, and I think it's really important. We have a prime minister who's got integrity. We've got to back him to succeed. That's what my constituents want.
That is the voice of a Labour MP, the Labour MP for Birmingham, Edgbaston, Preet Kaur Gill.
So you're absolutely right, Neil. There has been more shade than light today because important things have had to be considered. But this is Neil's contribution. What is wider, the moon or Australia? Listen on that. Maybe the fun bus just didn't stop. Maybe it's about to. We're going to talk about an Olympic Games being held in the north of England. We'll do that in our new sports slot with Vassos Alexander. We are Jane and Fee at times.radio at 0333 003 2353. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk or visit your local Wix store.
My dad is more than just a dad. My dad provides life-changing support to those affected by disaster and conflict, helping people in crisis, whoever and wherever they are. Through the gift that he left in his will to the British Red Cross, my dad still makes a difference to the world, even though he's no longer with us. You can make a difference too. Please go online and search Red Cross Wills and consider leaving a gift in your will to the British Red Cross.
Ever wondered how it feels to explore Europe on a luxurious river cruise, or which new local delicacy you'll try on board each evening? Ever wondered what it's like to fall asleep in one country, then wake up in another? Or how our local guides always find the finest spots at every stop? With an all-inclusive drinks package on all our luxury European river cruises, along with 10% off all 2026 holidays, it's a wonder why we'd choose anyone else. Book today to secure your choice of cabin with Riviera Travel. Apt and at all protected.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens, helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wix.co.uk.
Right, Neil, you've played a blinder here, so we've all been looking this up. The width of Australia, 4,000 kilometres. The width of the moon, 3,476 kilometres, although the moon has a greater surface area. Why is that, Jane?
Well, because it's a spherical object.
That's very good. Very, very good indeed. Show your workings in the margin now. Keely Hodgkinson's backing a bid for the north of England to host the Olympics. The 800-metre gold medalist told The Times that she'd try to keep running if the 2036 Games were awarded to Manchester. By then, she'd be 34. A group including the Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham is calling for any future bid to be focused on the north. Let's talk about this with Vassos Alexander. So we were trailing this item, and it's a great piece to read in the Times today. And the point isn't that we've never applied for different cities to have the Olympics before, and that they haven't been held in different cities in different countries before. It's the idea that the North would be a thing that is recognisable enough to people to be a coherent place to have the bid.
Yes, so, I mean, there's something called the Great North, which is a kind of mayoral collaboration led by, I don't know whether it's led by, but it certainly seems to be led by Andy Burnham, the Manchester mayor, and they're sort of trying to elevate the voice and visibility of the North. And so he has said, well, hang on, Sadiq Khan. Yes, London could go for the Games in 2036 or 2040, but what about the North of England? I mean, I love the idea. Do you remember when London were awarded the Games and we were thinking beach volleyball on Horse Guards Parade and all of, you know, all of the, what if it's just, that's going to be amazing. But open water swimming on Lake Windermere, and then, you know, dinghies whipping along the Mersey for the sailing, and the athletics in the Etihad Stadium. I don't know, it sounds like a lot of fun to me.
Yes, it sounds absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And we're not knocking it at all. Jane did raise the point that there is sometimes some rivalry in the North.
Yeah, well, I've pointed out let's be honest, the really full-bodied loathing between certain major North of England cities.
Yes, they might have to park that.
Well, the Scousers are not over the Manchester Ship Canal. That was the start of it all.
So the next Olympics are in LA, and then the ones after that are in three cities along the Gold Coast of Australia, but it's being called the Brisbane Games. So I think it would have to be called, for example, the Manchester Games. I remember in the early 90s, Manchester made a bid for the Olympic Games, a proper sort of grown-up bid that went to the IOC, and it was voted down. I can't remember. Maybe it was Atlanta that got it at that stage. But, you know, Manchester have been in this hat before. They would maybe have to sort of spearhead the bid. But, you know, it's up. I was looking up how many tourists went to Paris because of the Olympic Games a couple of years ago, and it was 11 million. Manchester get 1 to 1.5 million overseas visitors every year. So,
it would be phenomenal.
In 2 weeks, yeah. You know, they would 10 times that.
Yeah, and they've got stadium. And as you say, you know, there is a huge amount of venue space for all of those different sports. Tell us about what Keely Hodgkinson has promised then.
So she, slightly jokingly, she's 23 years of age now. She's already Olympic gold medalist. She trains in Manchester. She's from around there.
Yeah.
And she says, look, if it's, can you make it 2036, not 2040, please. And then I'll be 34 and I'll stick around. I'll make sure I run in my home Olympic Games. There's a big cost, obviously, to putting on the Olympics. It was £9 to £10 billion to put on London. But there's a lot of urban regeneration that comes. I mean, the equivalent sort of, if we're sort of worldwide eyes on the, you know, the North of England, yeah, as it would be in this stage, is just huge. Very difficult to quantify it, but it's the equivalent to, say, a massive governmental marketing campaign.
Mm. And the London Games have been hugely successful in terms of keeping the site going, turning it into something afterwards, because there are some pretty legendary disasters, aren't there,
Athens,
from early Olympics.
Mm. I mean, Athens is the big one. You know, you go to Athens, and then there's, you know, you see the Acropolis and, you know, like the ancient ruins, and then you see lots of white elephants from the 2004 Olympics. They were very unlucky, Athens, actually, because 9/11 happened while they were building the games, and then suddenly security costs just went stratospheric, and then the whole world was saying to Athens, you're not going to be able to cope, and Athens saying, yes, we are, but then they had to put masses more money into it, and then you know, and then there, it was a great big pride. I mean, I'm speaking as a Greek. I remember covering the Athens Olympics for the BBC as I was. It was really lovely at the time. Well, but
was I not in the same hotel as you?
I think we might have been.
Yeah, it was lovely. It I had a really great nice, time yeah. in Athens. I mean, partly because my children were toddlers and yeah. it was just a brilliant break.
I'm glad you two made such an impact on each other's lives.
We did have a great time.
Relive the good times.
That was a good trip.
Yeah. It was a good trip. But yes, Athens has been paying since.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Can there only be one bid per country?
I don't know the rules on that. That's a very good question. I would assume so. I think the IOC would sort of would look down on Manchester and London having rival bids. But why not? Why, I mean, if it's not against the rules, just go for it.
Mm. The bid itself costs a lot to do that,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And you remember, you know, Lord Cohen and all of his, you know, cohort going over to Singapore in their white suits to try and, you know, present. It's a big deal. They're trying to tone that down and make it a little bit more streamlined and make it just less costly, the whole thing, and less just less hoopla.
Yeah.
I quite enjoyed it. I quite enjoyed that time, you know, when the envelope gets opened.
Oh, it's brilliant.
And the awarded to the city of...
And it wasn't Paris.
And it wasn't Paris, it was London.
We should say...
David Beckham.
Yes.
Oh, yes, David Beckham.
Who was it? It was...
well done, David.
Yes. Andy Burnham. I mean, what a triumph this would be for the self-styled King of the North if it came to pass.
It would be. It would be wonderful. I mean, just... Instinctively, I don't know how you feel, but I mean, an Olympic Games in the north of England, London have had it three times most recently, you know, in you know, within the last decade or so. So a north of England Olympic Games, just it feels great. Just
yeah. Well, that's where the sporting, the real sporting glory, the sporting passion actually resides in England. I'm not talking about the rest of the UK, but that's where it is, in the north.
And there's always the, you know, the medals table. And somebody
Yorkshire.
Will, yeah, the Yorkshire medals table. You know, yeah. there's so many gold medals won for Team GB in the north of England. Obviously, you know, Scotland and Wales as well, and the south of England. But you know, there's at some stage in an Olympic Games, Yorkshire will be there or thereabouts, equal with a Team GB medal total.
Yeah. Brilliant.
A quick word about what's happening with the medals in Milan Cortina. They're breaking, aren't they? And I don't mean people are breaking the records to win the medals, but the actual medals are breaking, yes. Vassos. What's yes. happened?
They are. I think it's the bit that holds the ribbon onto the medal. That bit just comes off. So if you're at all effusive with your medal, and why wouldn't you be? You've just won an Olympic medal. It comes off. But the athletes are finding it all rather hilarious, and the IOC have said, we're going to look into it.
Well,
sorry.
Of course they should. I mean, I have to say, of all of the things that you think would break, it isn't the thing that you've spent however long training for, that you want to keep for life, that you want to hand down to your grandchildren.
Yeah, I mean, they're not splitting in two. They're just, the ribbons are coming off.
Okay, one of them has split in two, Vassos. I've read this, that a medal has just, you know, gone.
Well, literally.
Yes.
I have not seen that.
Okay.
As of yesterday, they weren't splitting in two.
I don't want to fight you on this.
I don't want to, you know, be negative, but Britain was supposed to win the medals yesterday.
Don't be negative, then. Let's just move on. We're almost at the news. We could have got through this entire conversation without that.
In the past 24 hours, Team GB have come fourth. Three times.
That's hard, isn't it? That is
most
hard.
Recently this afternoon in the curling.
Oh no, they didn't even get. They
I know,
didn't get bronze.
I know.
Oh,
and that's exactly the same as happened to them 4 years ago as well.
Oh, that's wretched.
That fourth place is just awful,
isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Well, you've brought us down. Thank you very much for that. We'll talk to you again tomorrow. Oh dear. I feel sad now, Jane.
Let's cheer ourselves up. Our big interview this afternoon is with Lisa McGee, the creator and writer of Derry Girls. She has a new show called How to Get to Heaven from Belfast. We'll hear all about that in a couple of minutes' time. It's Times Radio. Here are the headlines from Stuart Willey at 3:30.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer has declared he knows what and who he's fighting for. The Prime Minister told an event in Hertfordshire he won't walk away from the mandate he was given at the last election. It follows days of fighting off calls for his resignation. The Mayor of Greater Manchester and potential challenger for the leadership, Andy Burnham, has called for stability across the Labour Party.
They've kind of come forward with the big ambitions. I think what we all need to do now is drive the pace of change more quickly. And that means greater unity across the whole of the Labour family, Labour movement.
A Polish woman who cut her girlfriend in half and buried her in a garden more than 15 years ago has been found guilty of murder. Anna Podawarna killed Izabela Zabloka at the house they shared in Derby. The Environment Agency is urging people to remain vigilant as downpours across England continue. There are currently 98 flood warnings in place across the country. 66 migrants have been rescued in the English Channel after their small boat's engine failed off the coast of Calais. French authorities responded on Sunday evening. And Claudia Winkleman is joining Channel 4's Crafts lineup. The Traitors presenter will host the dog show alongside Claire Balding when it returns to Birmingham's NEC next month. For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio. My dad is more than just a dad. My dad provides life-changing support to those affected by disaster and conflict, helping people in crisis, whoever and wherever they are. Through the gift that he left in his will to the British Red Cross, my dad still makes a difference to the world, even though he's no longer with us. You can make a difference too. Please go online and search Red Cross Wills and consider leaving a gift in your will to the British Red Cross.
If you could sail anywhere in the world, where would you go? With Oceania Cruises, our small luxurious ships allow us to dock in boutique ports in 600 stunning destinations. We offer a more immersive experience and a personalized service, creating unique travel memories. From the Caribbean to the Mediterranean and the finest cuisine at sea, it can only be Oceania Cruises. Visit OceaniaCruises.com or your travel agent.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles. Whether it's your first home or your forever home, find your dream kitchen at Wix. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
We both like Neil's suggestion, don't we?
Very much so, yes.
As you say, he says, I think we should hold the Olympics in Cornwall and feed the athletes only Cornish pasties and cream teas. I think it would be the perfect antidote to the so-called enhanced games. Now, that would be a spectacle well worth watching, wouldn't it?
It certainly would. Yeah. I'm never going to be able to get my head around the enhanced games.
I think it's awful.
Yeah.
And without being too sort of pompous about it all, it's just horrible.
Oh, be pompous about that one.
I think it's vile.
Yeah, me too.
Okay. Thank you for all your messages. Sorry, I'm moving away from the microphone because I'm lunging towards the text screen. I understand why people get irate when we talk about the north, and we were talking there about the north of England, weren't we? Gillian says, no mention of the northeast again, or is that South Scotland? Right. Sam says, the benefits of hosting the Olympics. Have you seen the benefits that hosting London 2012 brought to the Stratford area in East London? Well, we did talk about that, didn't we?
Yeah, but I mean, it's been phenomenal.
Yeah, and Sam says, housing, transport, shopping centre, infrastructure, sports facilities. It was worth every 0.01p of the 9 billion cost. This was a rejuvenation that would likely never have happened if it wasn't for the Games. And Sam doesn't have any skin in the game because he says he's from Brecon. So it's not like he's living the dream in Stratford. But you would absolutely say that's true and that it's really improved that part of London.
I think it's been incredible. I mean, it has saved that part of East London from a fate that nobody really wanted to imagine. And the regeneration, I think, is, you know, it's world renowned now. You know, we got tube stations, we got transport, we got a university campus, we got stuff that really has lasted and it has changed that part of East London. Nothing else was going to come there, Jane. It didn't have the right kind of industrial makeup for the modern era. Mm. And I would argue, you know, that parts of the north of England, they will fare so much better by having exactly that injection of 0.01p than waiting to get money from, as Andy Burnham would say, a very difficult to open Westminster wallet sometimes. So I'd back that bid totally.
Keith says, Manchester may have sporting arenas, but it doesn't have the infrastructure with regards to hotels, etc. Well,
but neither did London, though. So parts of London were completely and utterly accommodating for tourists, but that part of East London
didn't have.
No. And the way that they put the tube stations in, made the transport possible, made it accessible, you know, built Olympic Village for the athletes, you know, really proves that you can. you really can.
They have got to sort out public transport, though, in the northwest.
I mean, the fact that
you can't actually get a train all that easily.
And also because you wouldn't be able to fly directly in there, would you?
No, that's probably true. And Vin just makes the point, even bidding has a massive impact in pulling people together, says Vin. So it sounds as though, perhaps that surprisingly, there's a load of enthusiasm for the idea of another Olympic bid, this time from the so-called north of England. Right, let's bring in our guest this afternoon. If you are a fan of Derry Girls, the brilliant comedy on Channel 4, you might imagine that its writer and creator would be spirited and funny. And you'd be right. She is Lisa McGee, who now has a new show called How to Get to Heaven from Belfast. It starts on Netflix this Thursday. Now, it's quite unusual, this. It's part supernatural thriller, part highly amusing crime caper, and stars genuine Irish acting royalty who are clearly having the time of their lives. And there's fantastic scenery. Lisa told me where the show's title comes from.
A long time ago, like years ago, I was actually a student at Queen's University in Belfast. A street preacher handed me a flyer with that on it, and I kind of put it in my pocket. I just thought it would be so great for a comedy. You know, it's such a kind of interesting, mysterious title for something. So I kind of kept it in my, you know, locked away.
Yep, absolutely. Well, it's golden. And you didn't go to the meeting that the flyer was advertising or
no,
anything like that?
No, that wasn't my vibe at university, really.
No. Okay. So what year were you at university? Let's just put this all in place.
So I would have been at Queen's from 2000, I guess. Yeah. And I did a drama degree there. We were the first drama degree. The first time they offered a drama degree was my year. Yeah.
Okay.
We had a great time.
Right. And so you were considered quite unusual then. Because I did English university and I remember the drama students were at the other end of the corridor and they just seemed to be having a better time than the rest of us. And they wore leg warmers. I mean, this is the 80s. There was a kind of glamour attached to them that there just wasn't to the English students.
I find it like I loved it and I had a great time, but I couldn't act at all. I definitely knew I wanted to write going into that course. But it was very performance focused.
Oh.
So like I got a lot of kind of parts that were third servant from the left sort of thing for about 3 years, and then kind of slowly built up a small writing portfolio, I guess.
Okay, so did you write this or parts of this then, or was it Derry Girls you were thinking about? What was going on?
Well, I wrote a play at uni with the same title, but it was very different. I guess it was still about a group of young women then. And then I wrote plays for ages and then moved onto TV and wrote a lot of different stuff. I always said I would never write about the Troubles, and then it was like, you know, ironic that that's exactly what Derry Girls was, but through a very different lens, you know. I think I probably had the idea for this a while ago, somewhere in my head, and then, you know, it all came together when it was, I think I needed to be a bit older to write this because of the characters and the stage they're at in life and stuff.
Yeah, we'll talk about Derry Girls a little bit later because it's just a series that just means so much, I think, to so many people. But the characters in this one are, well, they've moved on a bit, they're 38.
Yes.
I mean, they're sort of heading towards
40.
And there's quite a lot going on. So just set those characters up. There are three women, all very different.
Yes. So one is there's three friends since school. Now they're 38. One's a kind of chaotic but very clever television writer, quite successful. One is a glamorous, stressed out mum of three. And the other is I would describe Dara as the moral compass of the show. She's a carer for her mum.
Who isn't that ill.
Who isn't that ill, yes, exactly.
which is just fantastic. It really makes me laugh. Yeah, carry on.
I think Dara's a need to be needed is one of her big qualities. And she's also quite religious, you know, quite a nervous she's still in her teenage bedroom. I think she's quite afraid of life, do you know?
Yeah.
But the three of them are very close. And they discover that an old pal from childhood who they haven't seen in 20 years has passed away. They decide to go to her wake and all is not as it seems. And they get drawn into this kind of crazy, eerie journey that takes them all over Ireland and beyond, really.
And that's what's so good about this. I've only seen two episodes. I think there are eight altogether, aren't there?
Yeah,
okay. It actually comes out on Thursday, the 12th, so
yes.
People can gird their loins until then. But let me tell you, it's worth waiting for. It is a comedy, but there's also a sort of
supernatural element. It's quite frightening as well.
Yeah.
What kind of mood are you trying to create here?
Well, weirdly, like, one of the big reference points was Scooby-Doo. You know, we
okay, I never liked Scooby. I didn't like any of it. I didn't like all those funny fairgrounds.
But I know what you mean. Just this idea that there was something that felt creepy, but actually, like, any supernatural element in this is coming from a very real thing. You know, like, they're haunted by what they did. They're haunted by their younger selves. They're haunted by the things they didn't do. Do you know? So I like the idea of doing that kind of spin on a supernatural story, but it feels quite creepy, yeah, in places. The tone of it's quite spooky, I would say.
Yeah, it is. Well, the shades of the Addams Family in a couple of scenes, certainly. But it's also a caper. It also properly makes you laugh out loud. And there's also, we need to say, there's a male love interest figure who, I mean, let's just be honest. I think one of my children happened to see one of the previews I was watching over the weekend. Oh, who's that? I said, well, it's a young man. It's perfectly appropriate for you to find him attractive, but I certainly can't myself. I mean, and he is both a mechanic and a guard, an Irish police officer.
That's right.
Now, tell me, is he throughout the series?
He is. So he's the big love interest for one of the characters.
Right.
And yeah, I think there's a lot of, it is a big adventure, and there's a lot of sort of wish fulfillment in that, like, I would love to go on the road with my friends and solve a mystery. You know, a lot of women of my age listen to a load of true crime and really believe, I think, they would have a good crack at sorting it all out. The reality of that is that I think me and my friends would be as chaotic and awful, and, you know, as this group of women. So
not brilliant drivers.
Not brilliant drivers, not brilliant detectives either, but they kind of learn to get better, you know, and they use their real life skills. So the fact that Robin's a mum, she starts to really use those instincts later in the series. The fact that Saoirse's very creative, she starts to lean into that to solve this thing. And Dara, you know, has a very strong moral core, and that's helpful to them. So I think they learn to play to their strengths towards the end. But there's, you know, it's still quite messy.
Yeah, it's gloriously messy. Saoirse's character is she's a very successful TV crime show writer.
Yes.
Are you conscious that maybe having a character who's a TV writer is hints of disappearing up your artistic artistic fundament? What do you say about that?
More than hints, I would say. And also, like, I was at one point just writing long speeches where I was just venting about my own frustrations with the industry, and my two, you know, brilliant executive producers, Liz Lewin and Caroline Letta, who I've worked with for years, were like, Lisa, you know, we need to cut all this. This is not, you know, it's not part of the story, nor is it funny, so, like, let's just lose this. But yeah, totally, it was sort of irresistible to be able to get to rant and rave a bit.
Well, I love the bits where Saoirse often references that she lives in London, and Robin in particular, you don't live in London. So just tell me about, I mean, there is obviously an antipathy between, I mean, I get it completely, why wouldn't there be, but is that something that crops up a lot with people who like to bigfoot it when they get back to Northern Ireland and talk about their crazy lives in London?
I think it's a wee bit that writer thing of, you don't really feel you fit in anywhere. You know, when you're in London, you're banging on about being Irish all the time, and when you're at home, you're banging on about how you worked in London, you know. And I think, but I also just feel there was really a point for me. I lived in London for a long time where I was filming everything at home, you know, and I was doing it, and it was all the wrong way round, and it was like, kind of, that was Saoirse's story there is true of my, of what happened to me. So I liked being able to shine a light on that a little bit in a fun way too.
So when you are in Northern Ireland, because you are living back there now.
I live there now, yes.
Yeah, do you cringe when you hear yourself saying, when I was in London?
Well, I don't get away with anything. I tried to change my drink order once, and my friends, who I've been friends with since school, like, you'd have thought I committed a crime. Do you know, they were like, who do you think you are?
What did you ask for?
It was like a spicy margarita or something. They were like, sure, you only drink Prosecco? What's happened here? So yeah, I don't think I'd get away with it.
I think, God, you're so right. I mean, there's no... Prosecco's a terrible drink, and spicy margarita is the absolute champagne of drinks. I mean, I know that doesn't work, but I've said it anyway. There's also, in this show, I love the references to the fact that people who live in Derry are very different from people who live in Belfast. Now, but we're all very parochial. I'm from Liverpool. We're very rude about people from Manchester and vice versa. So is it the same? Is that the same dynamic?
I think everywhere has that relationship with another town, everywhere in the world, you know. So I think that's a sort of very specific thing that people, you don't need to be Irish even to enjoy that joke. I find that out from Derry Gears, that everyone has their Belfast or Strabane or whatever it is, you know. So I really lean into that now, you know, being very specific about stuff like that.
The cast list for this series is just astonishing. Just whet people's appetites. Just tell them who's in this.
So we have, well, there's so many. We have Ardal O'Hanlon, Michelle Farley.
Yep.
We have Saoirse Monica Jackson, Emmett Scanlon. We have the three leads, obviously, Sinead Keenan, Keelan Dunn and Roisin Gallagher. There's lots and lots of actors in it, just because it goes everywhere, you know, and you're meeting new people all the time.
I particularly enjoy Sinead Keenan, partly because she's in Unforgotten, which I really love, but there's not a lot of option there. She just looks very tense in a coat.
It's very serious.
Yeah, yes. No, I mean, you know, she visits some very difficult crime scenes. was it a relief to her to be able to just... I mean, she's still investigating a crime, of course, but it's on a slightly different level.
I mean, I think Sinead's a mom as well, and I think she really enjoyed... Like, I certainly enjoyed writing those bits where she's just being very stressed. And she's such an incredible comic. She's an incredible actress. She can do anything. But I think I've worked with her in a few comedies, and I think to be able to stretch that muscle about her, come back to the silly stuff is very enjoyable, you know. It's certainly enjoyable to watch her.
I think every mother loves the bit. She just, because she's investigating a crime, she just quite often has to leave hubby in charge of the kids.
Yes.
And he always looks a little bit...
Stressed
out and somewhat taken aback.
Yeah.
And you're right, it's that Thelma and Louise, we're on the road and we're going to do something together feel about it.
Yeah, and go and sort of... tuning into that energy they had when they were teenagers, because that was a big thing. You know, when you were a bit sort of, you didn't know what was ahead of you, so you were a bit braver, but more naive maybe. And I think just they need that kind of, that they need to rely on that teenage spirit nearly to solve this thing.
You mentioned your friends who took the proverbial because you changed your drink order, but do you honestly think that you ever laugh again in the way that you did with your friends when you were a teenager? I sometimes think about this myself and get a bit maudlin.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Like, my friends that I'm still friends with make me laugh more than anyone or anything ever. Well, we are all still incredibly ridiculous figures, I think. But yeah, those days where and it could be like, I remember one day in school, a chair squeaked. Like, that was literally the height of the comedy, and we laughed for hours. Like, I thought, this is how I'm going to die. I'll not stop laughing. Just that real, real giddy silliness I miss.
Yeah. Do you ever go back to your old school? Is that possible?
I'm going back soon. I'm going to go and I think talk about writing and stuff like that.
And they're proud of you, obviously.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think they'd be too thrilled by some of the swearing, I hope it kind of encourages other young gears to get into comedy writing, you know. I would love that.
Well, that's what's so refreshing about this show and about Derry Girls, is that there are, I mean, women are sold often comedy by men that features men's view of what women might say and how they might behave.
Yeah.
I mean, has that been a long-term frustration for you, or did you just accept it, do you think?
I mean, I certainly always felt like I'd never saw myself represented and my friends, like, because, you know, like being the really, really chaotic, messy one causing the problem a lot of the time. I love that they're right at the centre of the pickle, as I call it, that these women and the Derry Gears were too. But, you know, I did have, there were things like Ab Fab for me growing up. You know, like I did definitely know that women were funny. I was surrounded by funny women. So I kind of just maybe had never seen the... Irish version of that, well, you know?
When you first showed Derry Girls to, I don't know how it starts, but do you show it to a commissioner or who, an agent or...?
I'd written a script and showed it to Channel 4, yeah.
Okay.
I think that's how it worked, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And they see a comedy featuring young girls and, of course, the notable boy at a school... in Derry during the Troubles, and it's a comedy.
Yeah.
I mean, what did they say to you?
I mean, to be fair to Channel 4, they got it immediately. They read the script and it just clicked and they understood how it could work. But I think they also understood if it was to work, I'd have to have ownership. It was so particular of everything, do you know? You know, which isn't unusual in comedy. I'm on set all the time and I'm very involved, but I think that that's kind of how most sitcoms work. But yeah, they were very, very supportive and they really got the vision. You know, they were incredible.
And to be clear, to anybody who hasn't seen it, you're not laughing at the Troubles,
no.
But you are, well, what are you doing? You're celebrating the community that existed at that time.
Yeah, the ordinary people and the just the everyday stuff that had to go on. But I think, you know, often when I'm writing something, I'll have to have a line in my head that sums it up. And my line for Derry Girls was, you know, yeah, you know, there's the Troubles, but being a teenager, that's the real Troubles. Do you know that the idea that this all paled into insignificance compared to trying to find a boyfriend, trying to get your exam done, you know,
that spot that was driving you up.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So that was the sort of guiding thing for me, was these very dramatic, very selfish teenage girls who were just glorious to write.
Yeah, and just so navel-gazing.
which
we absolutely
so
all
were. So obsessed with themselves.
And you were, I assume, educated by nuns.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And these are the nuns that are welcoming you back to the school.
I don't think there's any nuns that teach there now.
Right.
I think that those days are kind of gone. Although I'm not sure. But certainly in my day, there were a lot of nuns teaching there.
Okay, so I'm bound to ask you which one influenced the Sister Michael.
It was a combo of a few. I mean, they were all terrifying. Do you know, they all terrified me, but they were very... Now I look back and I go, you know, they were trying to get a lot of boisterous working class girls to, you know, get really good exam results. It probably wasn't easy. They really wanted at that school the best for us, I think, but they were incredibly strict, you know, and incredibly scary.
And did you get teaching about sex and relationships or anything?
Oh, God, no. No.
Oh, God, no.
No.
Right, okay.
Not at all, no.
Right, so you were left to fathom that out on your own?
To work it out with your friends, probably, like, get a lot of stuff wrong as well, yeah, just to sort of try and figure it out. Yeah, there was none of that.
Right. I'm sure they were very wise simply to avoid the subject. So I think people are going to absolutely love this. What's next after this? Are you going to do something completely different? Have you got another great title in the mix?
I want to do another comedy. Like, I want to do another, like, half hour. Do you know, you always want what you don't have, because I've written the hour long thrillery thing now that I wanted to do for ages. I'm like, maybe I'll do just a normal comedy again. But I'd love to do more of this if people watch it. I'd love to do another series of this. So we'll just have to see.
They're going to investigate another murder?
Yeah. Yeah, get themselves in more trouble. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll definitely watch that. The beautiful scenery, by the way, is exquisite. I know you go abroad at one point. I've only seen the first two. So is it Donegal that they go to that just looks wild and absolutely amazing?
Yeah, we go to Donegal and all around the north coast of Ireland and Belfast and, yeah, everywhere. We go everywhere, basically, yeah.
Okay, so if all you want is a tourist guide to Northern Ireland, you should watch this programme, but you'll get much more out of it than that. My favourite character, I've got to be honest, is the... more than taciturn waitress.
She's great.
Well, have you worked as a waitress or a barmaid?
Very briefly when I was a teenager and had to sidestep that and work in shops then. Like, it's hard work. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But you wouldn't have been not as bad as her.
I don't think I'd have been rude. Yeah, I'd just have been really, really bad and slow.
Okay, well, that's infinitely preferable. Lisa McGee, who's the creator of Derry Girls, and her new show starts on Netflix on Thursday. It's called How to Get to Heaven from Belfast. I just realised, listening to that, which was recorded earlier, I said a tourist guide to Northern Ireland. I meant north of Ireland. just to be clear about that. Because, yes, it's easy to cause offence. Neil says, my mother was from Belfast, my father was from Derry. He had to propose to her five times before she said yes. When he asked her why she refused his proposal five times, she said, because you're a Derry culchi, which is a defamatory term for uncultured folk. They actually were married for 55 years, and she called him a Derry culchi up to and including her final day, says Neil. So she never veered from that. Quite right.
You're listening to Jane and Fee with Wickes, the kitchens and bathrooms expert. You can pop along to a local Wickes store or indulge in their sale at wickes.co.uk.
Times Radio, Market Watch, in association with FNC Investment Trust. Listen to Times Radio to hear all the latest financial news from all the global stock markets. Get insight, analysis and up-to-the-minute information to help you get the most from your investment portfolio. Times Radio, Market Watch. Throughout the day, every Monday to Friday, on Times Radio, in association with FNC. It's smart to start with FNC. Find out more at fnc.com. Capital at risk.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house, and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly. To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
If you could sail anywhere in the world, where would you go? With Oceania Cruises, our small luxurious ships allow us to dock in boutique ports in 600 stunning destinations. We offer a more immersive experience and a personalized service, creating unique travel memories. From the Caribbean to the Mediterranean and the finest cuisine at sea, it can only be Oceania Cruises. Visit oceaniacruises.com or your travel agent.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
So just to refer back to our earlier conversation we were having with Vassos Alexander about the Great North bid, potential bid for the Olympics in 2036, we were talking about transport that was available and I said, you know, you can't fly directly into Manchester. Now, that's a complete lie because you can. There is Manchester International Airport. The point I was trying to make was that there is a plethora of international airports around London which do make it easier to fly into the south of England. You've got Heathrow, Gatwick, Stansted, City, Luton and something called London South End now as well. Fun times, I know. Join us tomorrow where we listen.
Tell you what, Fee, that was wonderful. I felt extremely educated. I don't like it when you make these apologies. You just go, girl. Don't you worry about it.
Well, I don't want to offend people. I'm sure that Manchester International Airport is incredibly busy. But I also like to list a transport option. So I've got it out of my system, Jane, and I've listed transport options.
Well, you didn't mention Liverpool John Lennon.
I'm so sorry. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. I've made things worse, not better.
Right. Victoria wants to make the case for being educated by nuns. She says, my nuns, the nuns she was taught by, taught us values and how to look after things, e.g. how to polish a table. Well, there you go.
Good. Stand you in very good stead for the rest of your life.
Who's our guest tomorrow?
Our guest tomorrow is Zach Goldsmith. Now, you might think that he was in to talk about conservative politics, but he's not. He's got a whole new career as
I was surprised by this, as a sculptor.
He's doing big animal sculptures. A couple of them have come to rest in Boris Johnson's garden. So we're going to talk about that. We'll talk about conservation. We'll talk about nature versus politics. We'll probably talk about the Conservative Party.
Can I just squeeze in an apology now? Okay. So, listen, I'd said Northern Ireland when I meant north of Ireland. I wanted to correct that because I'd referenced Donegal in the conversation with Lisa McGee, and that's not in Northern Ireland, that's in the north of Ireland. So that's why I made that apology. I'm now having to defend an apology. I can't believe it's come to this, Fee.
Yep. They'll play this segment of the programme back in both our eulogies and we'll be very proud indeed. Thank goodness we're going. Our producer today was Felix Forbes. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. The ultimately professional John Pienaar is next with Drive. Thank goodness for that.
Have a good night.
across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Keir Starmer says he will never walk away from the country I love. And Wes Streeting has been reprimanded by the Metropolitan Police for publishing his messages and emails to Peter Mandelson. Now, coming up, we'll be taking stock of Keir Starmer's position. I'll be talking to Times Radio's political editor and to Labour MPs too in the course of the programme. And as Benjamin Netanyahu prepares to visit the United States, we'll brief you on what will be on his agenda and talk to the Times Israel correspondent.
This is Times Radio.
And here's the news with Stuart Willey.
John, thank you. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister says he'll never walk away from the job after days of fighting off calls for his resignation. Sir Keir Starmer insists he'll lead Labour into the next general election. Speaking at an event in Hertfordshire, he declared he knows what and who he's fighting for.
There are some people in recent days who say the Labour government should have a different fight, a fight with itself. And I say to them, I will never walk away from the mandate I was given to change this country. I will never walk away from the people that I am charged with fighting for. And I will never walk away from the country that I love.
The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has been rebuked by police and Downing Street for publishing messages exchanged with Peter Mandelson. Other ministers have been urged not to follow suit, with the Metropolitan Police saying its vital due process has followed to avoid compromising its investigation into leaks of government information. It's understood Streeting failed to get clearance before releasing the messages. A teenager who killed a 12-year-old in an unprovoked random attack will spend at least 13 years in prison. Leo Ross was stabbed in the stomach while walking home from school. The now 15-year-old killer, who can't be named for legal reasons, also injured three elderly people in the days before the incident, pushing an 82-year-old woman into a river. Two boys have been stabbed at a school in North London. A 12-year-old and a 13-year-old have been injured and taken to hospital. Police say a major operation to find the teenage suspect is underway. A masked gang posing as police has blown the doors from an armoured van in a robbery similar to the cult film The Italian Job. Video shot by motorists in southern Italy shows the men wielding Kalashnikovs before making a dramatic getaway. Two have been arrested on suspicion of attempted murder and weapons charges. James Imam reports for The Times from Milan.
It's a road which is famous for this sort of heist. I mean, something very, very similar happened about 2 years ago. The robbers this time, the police I spoke with said there were probably about eight of them, brought traffic to a standstill. They did that in pretty dramatic ways by setting a stolen van on fire. All of a sudden, you see a massive explosion and the doors have been blown off. The roof has been blown off.
Forecasters say there's no chance of any prolonged dry spells for the next 10 days. 100 flood warnings are in place across southern England, Wales and the East Midlands. Some areas have had rainfall every day this year, including on the Somerset Levels, where James Winslade's farm is. Water pumps have been installed there, but he says more permanent defences are needed.
Bridgewater is lower than us. Bridgewater is a major town with tens of thousands of houses. It's got Hinkley Point on it. It's got the motorway in a floodplain. So it will cost hundreds of millions, if not billions, if it gets into there.
For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. So, now, Andy Burnham has expressed support for Keir Starmer, more or less, and the Labour Welsh leader too. So, more relief for the Prime Minister, just a little more breathing space. It would have been even better news for Starmer if either of them and all the Labour MPs who stood and cheered him at their meeting at Westminster last night were all quite as loyal to him as they let on. Of course, you might have believed, tell me if you do, that the Cabinet Ministers who lined up behind the PM yesterday were all as loyal as their tweets, and the MPs who cheered him on have been won over by Keir Starmer's force of personality and just buried their doubts, if they had any doubts. As it is, the Prime Minister is now generally assumed to be living on borrowed time. And meanwhile, Labour is limping towards disastrous local, Scottish and Welsh elections in May, which could be crunch time for the Prime Minister unless it comes sooner after the Gorton by-election in just over a fortnight's time. Now, none of us are clairvoyant, if the clairvoyants among us will forgive me for saying that, so who knows? A half-baked coup against the Prime Minister flopped like a wet pancake yesterday. We're going to be sharing the gossip about that and the whispers and denials that the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, stirred that pot and then ducked out when things got too hot. It did leave behind an astonishing mid-campaign rift between Labour's Scottish leader, who called on Starmer to quit, and Starmer, who is still there. And as for the effect of it, that, as we'll find out, is a matter of dispute, and I'll have more on that. And earlier, in the Cabinet, the Prime Minister is reported to have said the whole of the Labour Party wants the Scottish Labour leader, Anna Sarwar, to become the First Minister and will fight for a Labour government in Scotland. Well, I suppose in the surreal world of Labour today, it is possible for Keir Starmer and his remaining loyalists to wish Sarwar to win the Scottish election and for him to fall down a deep well at the same time. Today, I'm going to be trying to separate the spin from the scheming and to disentangle the alternate, competing realities that lie in Labour and our country's future. I'm going to try at any rate. Tell me what you think. 8722, start with the word Times, or tweet to @TimesRadio. First, though, earlier on, just before we came on air, the Prime Minister Keir Starmer was speaking in Hertfordshire, talking about speculation that he could go.
I will never walk away from the mandate I was given to change this country. I will never walk away from the people that I am charged with fighting for. And I will never walk away from the country that I love.
So, he's not giving up. I think we get the message. He also reinforced his focus on the cost of living.
I know that for you and for millions of people, what matters most is the cost of living. Actually paying the bills, getting through, improving living standards, public services that work, these are the things that matter hugely for people. They're the things that we were charged with changing when we won the election.
So Keir Starmer speaking earlier. Now, after yesterday's declaration by the Labour leader in Scotland that the Prime Minister should go, we wondered who might be next. We wondered if it might be perhaps the Labour leader in Wales. The Times was told from three sources that she shared Anna Sarwar's doubts about Starmer. But here we are today, the First Minister, Eleanor Morgan, being grilled in the Senate.
Can you, for clarity's sake right now, tell us, does the Prime Minister, First Minister, have your full confidence? Yes or no?
Yes, he does.
Well, we seem to answer that question today. Now, the Greater Manchester Mayor, Andy Morgan, he has been speaking too. He was at the Resolution Foundation. On his way, he confirmed the Prime Minister had, he said, support. He also called for stability across the party.
They've kind of come forward with the big ambitions. I think what we all need to do now is drive the pace of change more quickly. And that means greater unity across the whole of the Labour family, Labour movement.
Well, no doubt a lot of them would like that. But they have different ideas of what to unite and who to unite behind. Meanwhile, the Cabinet Minister, Ed Miliband, was speaking too. He had this to say about what the Prime Minister needed to do now.
This has got to be a moment of change for the government. Mm. A moment of change where we show much greater clarity of purpose, consistency of purpose. And my experience in politics is what gets you through very difficult days, and yesterday was a very difficult day, is mission and values.
Well, we're going to discuss what may have lain behind those words a little bit later too. Right now, let's welcome to the programme Anna Mikhailova, Times Radio's political editor. Hello.